This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why is it sometimes so hard to get an accurate diagnosis of your medical problem? My guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman, has dealt with that question as a patient and as a doctor. His new book about how doctors reach a correct diagnosis is called How Doctors Think. Dr. Groopman writes about medicine for The New Yorker. He teaches at Harvard Medical School and is chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Dr. Groopman says the most crucial part of the diagnostic process is that first conversation you have with your doctor when you describe your symptoms.
We as physicians tend to latch on to the initial information that we get from a patient. We're often working under time pressure, and we tend to make snap judgments and use shortcuts in thinking. So the first information we get, what we first hear, very strongly guides where our mind works and what conclusions we come to.
I want to immediately get to a misdiagnosis, a really interesting one that you begin your book with. And this is a woman who has lost so much weight, she's down to like 82 pounds. She feels sick after every meal. Describe what her symptoms are.
This is a woman I call Ann Dodge. She had seen more than 30 doctors. When she was 20 years old, she started to develop queasiness, abdominal pain, and really just disliked food. It became noxious to her. She saw a number of physicians, and the diagnosis of anorexia was affixed to her. And she had just a horrific, horrific course over the ensuing 15 years. Her bones degenerated. Her endocrine system became abnormal. She became anemic. Her immune system collapsed. She had meningitis. She was hospitalized 4 times in a psychiatric facility to try to get her to eat. And she claimed she was trying to eat. And she was cared for by an internist, a woman who specializes in eating disorders. But she kept withering away.
And how was an accurate diagnosis finally made?
Well, her boyfriend, around Christmas of 2004, told her, since she had developed some diarrhea in addition to all this abdominal discomfort, to see a gastroenterologist. The internist wasn't very enthusiastic about this. She had seen 30-plus doctors. She came to see a doctor in Boston, a gastroenterologist named Dr. Myron Falchuk. And instead of just taking her diagnosis, which every other doctor had received and accepted, he did something different. He sort of cleaned the slate, and he asked her to tell her story from the beginning. He listened carefully, and he asked himself a key question. What if she's telling me the truth? What if she is really trying to get down 3,000 calories a day? And she's still wasting away. And it turned out that she had celiac disease, which is an allergy to gluten, which is a very important component of bread and pasta and cereal. So here she was being forced to try to gain weight, eating these carbohydrates, which were only making her sicker.
Well, you say that patients can really help their doctors when their doctors are trying to come up with the right diagnosis of the problem. I mean, outside of like reporting your symptoms and answering the questions the doctor asks you, I mean, what can the patient do to really help with the diagnosis?
Well, there are a number of thinking errors that we as doctors make. We use shortcuts in our thinking. They're called heuristics in psychology. And if a patient or a family member or a friend knows about these kinds of mistakes, he or she can ask very appropriate and very focused questions so that the doctor doesn't take a thinking detour. For example, a very simple question to challenge a diagnosis if the person's not getting better, like this woman, is what else could it be? Could two things be going on simultaneously? Those are really critical kinds of questions that any layperson can ask.
Now, a lot of medicine relies on making diagnoses through scans and blood tests, but apparently you also need judgment there, too. I mean, as a patient, you often think that these things are empirical. Either there's a tumor or there's not. Either the blood test is positive or it's negative. But the way you describe it, there's actually a lot of gray areas and judgment calls and misdiagnoses in these areas that we think of as being empirical.
Well, this to me was one of the major discoveries when I wrote the book, that I thought MRI scans and CAT scans and other high technology, like you say, was so reliable. It turns out that the error rate in radiology is between 20 and 30%. And that almost paradoxically, some of the higher tech scans, because they generate so many images, literally overwhelm the radiologist. There's also a set of thinking errors that radiologists are prone to. It's called search satisfaction. For example, they showed 100 board-certified radiologists 60 chest x-rays, which they said were taken as part of a routine yearly physical. One of the chest x-rays was missing the left collarbone because it had been totally eaten away by cancer. 60% of the radiologists missed the absent left collarbone.
That's pretty upsetting to hear that.
It was shocking to me. And it's been studied in Michigan and Pennsylvania why this happens. And it turns out that the radiologist, almost subconsciously, is focusing on the lungs and the heart, because that's usually where the action is. And his or her mind doesn't systematically inspect and consciously examine the bones and the other parts of the body that are shown on the chest x-ray.
You know, hearing you describe the problems makes me wonder, when you're a patient and you get a scan and the scan comes back negative, how do you really know that nothing was revealed, as opposed to the possibility that the radiologist reading the scan didn't notice something?
This is a difficult problem, and I think it factors into the scenario of what to do if you're not feeling better, if you're not getting better. Clearly, if the treatment works and you're restored to health, there's no question. But when you go back to your first doctor or you seek a second opinion, it's imperative, once you have the knowledge that the error rate can be so high with these scans, to ask that the scan be reexamined or even repeated. And one of the most important things is that there's a breakdown often in communication between the primary care doctor and the radiologist. One of the experts in scanning of the abdomen told me that he needs as much clinical information from the primary care doctor so he can calibrate the scan correctly to try to pick up what might be abnormal. If he just gets a vague diagnosis like abdominal discomfort, it's very hard for him with these high-tech scans to zone in on the area that may show what's wrong.
Now, you had a pretty serious adventure with misdiagnosis. You were having a wrist problem, very painful wrist problem. What were your symptoms?
Well, I had some trauma to my wrist. I never learned to type, so I was banging away at the computer. My hand got caught in an elevator door. I sort of probably have the klutz gene. And my hand started to swell, become red and hot and really painful. And I saw a hand surgeon, did x-rays, MRI, and so on. He didn't know what was wrong. And I was actually reassured that he was so honest with me. But after a number of months, as these symptoms persisted, he said to me, "You have a hyperreactive synovium," which is a mouthful of Latin. "There is no such thing." He basically invented a diagnosis. So I saw a second doctor who looked at my MRI scan, and every little abnormality he wanted to fix, although he wasn't sure what was causing all of the swelling and pain, he wanted to do three surgeries. I went to a third doctor. These were all eminent hand surgeons. This surgeon was, as I describe, almost on roller skates. He sort of zipped into the room, took a quick look at my wrist. He said, "I think you have a form of gout." Well, that didn't show up on any x-rays. It didn't make sense. I said, "Well, it doesn't seem to be gout." He said, "I'll figure it out when I operate on you." Then I got to a young hand surgeon who had just come to Boston. And he listened again to my story from the beginning. And he did something none of the others had done. He looked at my normal hand. And then he compared the two doing plain x-rays while I moved my hand. And it turned out that the ligament which attached two of the small bones had torn, and it didn't show up on the MRI. And he thought differently and creatively and openly, didn't make a snap judgment. And then he was also very honest with me. He told me that he had never done this particular kind of repair before. So I went to yet another hand surgeon who had, and had the operation, and it was largely successful.
No, I think the most terrifying diagnosis you got during this was that it was actually metastasized cancer, because somebody did one doctor did a scan of your stomach and thought that they saw cancer there by your ribs.
Yes, this was extraordinary. And it taught me several lessons. One of the surgeons did a scan to look at my bones and so on.
Oh, that's right. It was a full body bone scan. That's what it was.
That's right.
Yeah.
So one of the surgeons did a full body bone scan. And it turned out my wife and family were away skiing. I was home alone. And I get a call around 8 o'clock at night, and the surgeon says to me, "You know, there's no real rush to fix your wrist because your ribs are studded with all of these lesions that look like metastatic cancer." And remarkably, within 20 seconds, my chest began to hurt. And I'm reasonably well put together psychologically. I'm not a hypochondriac or anything like that. But the terror of being told that I had metastatic cancer underlying all of this translated itself into real physical pain over my ribs. As you imagine, you know, I had a sleepless night. First thing in the morning, I went to the radiology suite and had x-rays done of my ribs, and they were completely normal. It was one of these errors in reading a scan.
So what lessons did you take away from this as a patient and as a doctor?
Well, first, I had never experienced psychosomatic symptoms before, and it shows you how powerful the mind can be in terms of expressing itself in physical symptoms in the body. The second is that this doctor did not doubt or question the results of the scan. And before you give someone a diagnosis of such gravity, given what the error rates are in reading these kinds of scans, I think it's imperative to carefully look, get a second opinion, get further x-rays, and of course, you don't tell someone home alone at 8 o'clock at night, an oncologist, nonetheless, that his body is riddled with bone cancer.
Let's look at the reverse side. We talked about a misdiagnosis that was made of your symptoms. Let's look at a time when, as a doctor, you misdiagnosed somebody's symptoms. Tell us about one of the times that happened and how it happened.
Well, I tell several stories because I've made my share, and I haven't forgotten any of them. When I was a resident, there was a woman who was complaining of discomfort under her breastbone, and she was, persistently complaining and I was young and impatient, and her voice sounded to me like a nail, you know, scratching across a blackboard. And I became very irritated with her. And I gave her antacids, and I made what's called an attribution error. I stereotyped her as being a complainer and a hypochondriac. She didn't have much relief, but I shut off my mind to thinking more expansively. And then I was paged to the emergency room, and she came in shock, and she had a tear in her aorta, the main vessel that takes blood from the heart. And I had missed it because I didn't think.
What should you have been thinking?
I should have, first of all, had a level of self-awareness about my own irritation. We are not perfect. There are patients we like more, patients we like less, people who we enjoy their company, people we find difficult for whatever reason. But we have to be professional, and we have to monitor ourselves. So I first should have said, you're clearly irritated. Don't let that color your thinking. Don't stereotype her. Don't make what's called an attribution error, a term I've only recently learned. And the second is, I should have kept searching because her symptoms didn't go away. Instead of just shutting off my mind, I could have said, what else could it be? What other anatomic structures are in that region that deserve a serious look? And then I could have also asked, what is the worst problem you could be missing? And indeed, a tear in the aorta is one of the worst problems that could be missed.
Did you apologize to her?
I apologized to her family because she died.
Right.
And it was awful for me and, of course, most awful for them. But I felt absolutely heartsick.
What did you say to the family?
I said that I had missed this, that I felt terrible about it. Many of my colleagues said, you know, she was elderly and she had this tear and such people often do poorly and so on. But that was really little comfort. And I explained to them that I really felt that I had made a significant error. And they very graciously and nobly accepted that.
What are some of the ways that practicing medicine has changed for you, for better and for worse, in the 30 years that you've been practicing, as a result of changes in managed care and in health insurance?
Well, I definitely feel, like all physicians, this tremendous time pressure. And I don't like it, and my patients don't like it. And I try to resist it as best I can, but it's not simple. This kind of factory mentality where people should be seen in 10 to 12 minute intervals. What's also changed, though, for the better, is I think people are much better informed. That we as physicians have learned to partner with patients rather than stand on a pedestal. I think it's key that patients and their family members know what's wrong with them, how we think about their problem, and feel completely comfortable to ask us challenging questions. And that didn't exist 30 years ago.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is the author of the new book, How Doctors Think. He writes for The New Yorker and is a professor at Harvard Medical School.